It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Mike Arnold, filling in today for Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert.
Now, yesterday and today, our theater's been jammed with newspapermen and hundreds of photographers from all over the nation, and these veterans agree with me that the city never has witnessed the excitement stirred by these youngsters from Liverpool who call themselves the Beatles. Now, tonight, you're going to twice be entertained by them. Right now and again in the second half of our show, ladies and gentlemen, the Beatles! That's
close your eyes and I'll kiss you tomorrow. This Sunday marks the 50th anniversary of one of the most important musical performances of all time, when the Beatles took the stage on the Ed Sullivan Show on February 9th, 1964. Popular music would forever be changed, and a wave of Beatlemania swept the United States.
And at the time, no one could have predicted what would come next for the Fab Four. Now in 2014, 50 years after the band first took America by storm, the Beatles are considered by many to be the greatest rock and roll band of all time, and their influence can be heard in music today.
Joining us now to talk about the legendary performance and the musical legacy of the Beatles is John Kovach. He's a professor and rock historian at the University of Rochester, and he's teaching a free online course called The Music of the Beatles on the website Coursera. John, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be with you.
That clip is something else. I love hearing Ed Sullivan, I guess, saying some youngsters from Liverpool. You can't imagine. It's the Beatles we're talking about there. But what was riding on this Ed Sullivan gig?
Well, I mean, if managers could figure out how to do what happened to the Beatles in early 1964, they would have done it over and over and over again. But it turned out to be a great coordination of talent, of personal charisma that the Beatles had. I mean, they were a very charismatic bunch of guys in a way that was really refreshing in this country at the time, and a kind of coincidence of a number of different business deals that had been started as early as September of 1963, when the Beatles were totally unknown in this country and couldn't get their records played on the radio anywhere.
Now was another thing beyond the business deals the fact that the Beatles showed up right after a pretty large national tragedy, the death of President Kennedy? I mean, do you think that contributed to the Beatles being such a success?
Well, I think partially. I mean, we could say that perhaps the country was ready for some good news and for something to kind of lose itself in. But it's not entirely clear that it should have been something having to do with music. And if it was going to have to do with music, it's not entirely clear why it should have been the Beatles, a group from not just England but Liverpool, places that had never really produced sustained success in terms of musical acts in this country. So even the Kennedy thing, there may be a certain amount of receptivity that was there, but why it should have been these particular guys and why they should have been a rock band, the Kennedy part of it doesn't explain that.
Now, you mentioned the business deals. What kind of deals did they have?
Through 63, if the Beatles had never made it in the U.S., they would have always been remembered in the history of British popular music for the success they had in 63, which in many ways convinced not only British musicians but fans alike that British groups could be as good as or even better than American groups up to that point. For the last couple of decades preceding it, since the Second World War, everybody in the UK really thought American pop was the best. And even those British homegrown groups, with only a few exceptions, were mostly imitating what the Americans were doing. But in 63, with the rise of the Beatles, that was viewed as music that came from their own home shores, even though it was very much influenced by American pop. And their overwhelming success in 63, really convinced people that, gosh, maybe British groups can be as good as American groups. But in spite of all that success, Brian Epstein could not figure out a way to get the band attention in the United States. They tried to release a couple of records. The first two ended up being rejected by Capitol. A U.S. subsidiary of their label in the U.K., EMI and Parlophone. Please, Please Me and From Me to You were both released by VJ. They went nowhere. Then they switched to Swan in September of 1963 with She Loves You. It went nowhere. They went with Swan partially because it was a Philadelphia-based label that Dick Clark used to be involved in before the Payola scandals, and they hoped maybe that connection might get the record on American Bandstand, and it did, but it only rated a 73, and DJ stopped playing it, you know, and so he was just beside himself. And so the way it worked is that United Artists had an office in London, and they had both the movie division and the record division, and there were guys who were working in London who saw this British success the Beatles were having. And so one of them was somehow able to look into the Beatles' contract with EMI and saw that it didn't say anything specific about soundtrack albums. So they proposed to Brian Epstein that they do a movie with the Beatles in order to get the soundtrack album that they could then release. So the movie could have lost money.
So was this sort of a
soundtrack?
Is this sort of a prototype music video we're talking about?
Well, you know, movies, fast and quick rock movies sort of go all the way back to Elvis and Alan Freed back in the 1950s. And so it was easy to sort of throw something together, you know, with a flimsy plot and a bunch of performances, basically to act as an advertisement to try to sell the records. So A Hard Day's Night was actually signed before the Beatles had any success in the United States. And at the same time, Sid Bernstein, a New York City promoter, had been trying to get a hold of Brian Epstein to book him into book the group into Carnegie Hall in February. And Ed Sullivan's UK talent scout, a fellow by the name of Peter Pritchard, had been sending Ed clippings of all that had been going on with the Beatles in the UK. And so Peter Pritchard put Brian Epstein in contact with Sullivan's people. He was in New York in early November 63, signed the Beatles to an unprecedented 3 shows in a row on the Ed Sullivan Show in February, locked down the Carnegie Hall gigs in the course of December and January, also booked an extra show in Washington, D.C. as a kind of warm-up show. And still they had no real airplay in this country until a DJ in Washington, D.C. by the name of Carol James started playing the record on Washington, D.C. radio before it was WWDC, before it had ever been released in this country. He got a copy because a young listener by the name of Marcia Albert had asked for it as a request, and their policy back in AM radio those days was to honor every request from a listener. He had a friend who was a stewardess on BOAC Airlines who could bring over a British copy. They played it on the radio, and all of a sudden the tune started to break out in the Washington, D.C. market.
So basically it was a little bit of business acumen and a little bit of luck.
Well, yeah. I mean, who would have known that an import—I mean, just to sort of put in question the idea of music industry wisdom. In early December, when an imported copy of I Want to Hold Your Hand started to break out in the Washington, D.C. market, Capitol, because they weren't planning to release the record until the middle of January, Brian had finally talked them into releasing it, they actually hired a lawyer to send a cease and desist letter to the Washington station to try to get them to stop playing their record.
So don't you think, though, that the Beatles were going to be huge no matter what happened, no matter how they broke? If they didn't break huge on the Ed Sullivan Show, they would have broken anyway.
Well, it certainly seemed to be happening that way when that record started to go viral, first in D.C., then Chicago and St. Louis. I mean, it went so viral that Capitol stopped trying to sue the station and moved the release date up to the, who would ever release a single on December the 26th? But that's what they did because it was the first date they could get those records in the stores to take advantage of this. By the last week of January, the record was number one on the Cashbox charts. By the first week of February, it was number one on the Billboard charts as well. And on February the 9th, they were playing on Ed Sullivan. What kind of timing is that? And then after that, they already had a movie deal, and they had a movie in the theaters by July of 1964. I mean, that's some kind of luck.
So they kind of hit big. They were lucky to have a lot of things in place. Yeah. Although I'm sure there were a lot of pop acts back in those days that did that. Why do you think their success, their initial success is exciting. But then after that, they sort of took it to a new level. This wasn't just like a pop band that hit it big. They seemed to go beyond that. What do you think it is about the Beatles that allowed them to do that?
Well, as I was just saying, they had the opportunity, but they also had the goods. I mean, they were a fantastic group. They had this wonderful composing team, songwriting team of John Lennon and Paul McCartney, and all this charisma and all this ability as singers. I mean, John and Paul were both good enough singers to have had their own solo careers, you know, and here they are singing together along with George Harrison. I mean, what a combination of talent. The opportunity presented itself. They never really were satisfied with without sort of moving forward. And so one of the great things about the Beatles is that they outlived the fad. I mean, initially they were a fad. They outlived the fad that brought them to fame. And a lot of groups didn't. Jerry and the Pacemakers, Herman's Hermits, the Dave Clark Five were pretty much gone when the British invasion was over. But the Beatles
continued. We're going to hit pause right now as we talk with John Kovach about Beatlemania. We're coming up on the 50th anniversary of the band's breakout performance on The Ed Sullivan Show. And we want to hear from you on this. Do you remember seeing the performance on TV? Did you experience Beatlemania? Do you understand it? It seems like it was over the top and we haven't really seen the like since. Why do you think that was? What was it about the Beatles that brought it on? 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. And you can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'd like to hear what you think about the Beatles, or maybe they never did anything for you. We'd love to hear that as well. 1-800-642-1234. You can join the conversation right after the break. But first, here's a look at some of the latest news with Kristen Durst.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Mike Arnold. We're celebrating 50 years of Beatlemania this afternoon. 50 years, do you believe that? The Beatles, they first started making a big splash in America 50 years ago. And a Beatles expert is here with us today, rock historian John Kovach. And we'd love to hear from you, too. What are your favorite memories of the band from the last 50 years? Why do you like the Beatles? We'd love to hear from you. Join the conversation at 1-800-642-1234. You can also send us an email at talk@wpr.org. The phones are on fire, so I think we're just going to go straight to a call. Glennis from Duran called. Glennis, you there?
Yes, I am.
All right. What's your story?
Well, I guess my Beatles story was when I was in high school, a friend of mine, we got together and we got a ride into Chicago. And we went to what was the amphitheater and watched the Beatles perform. And it was just a wonderful, great concert. And it was something I'll always remember.
Now, when you saw it, did you have a sense that the Beatles were going to be a group that people would be talking about many years later?
Oh, yes, I did. I mean, the place was just packed. And everybody was so excited after, you know, they had been on Ed Sullivan. And you know, it was a big thing. And everybody thought that they were just the greatest, I guess.
Now, did you just like the Beatles at the beginning, or did you sort of go through the whole transition? You know, I mean, did you as they changed their musical styles and stuff, did you stick with them the whole time?
I guess I did. I think I liked some of their music better than others, but I still am a huge fan of their music.
Well, thanks so much for that call, Glennis. We really appreciate it. John Kovach, I'm sure you hear a lot of stories like that as you talk to people about the Beatles.
Yeah, and, you know, with younger people who didn't experience that time, you know, they probably have to be told that those Beatles concerts only lasted about 30 minutes. And most of the time, you couldn't hear very much of what they were actually playing because people were screaming the whole time. But so I think that many ways, memories are shaped by the just intense emotional reaction to seeing the group, because you couldn't really hear them very long, and you couldn't hear them for a very long time, and you couldn't hear them very well amidst all the yelling and screaming.
I'm going to call. I think might speak to that. Let's go next to Tom joining us in Richmond, Illinois. Hi, Tom.
Hi. So I was 10 years old when they played the Ed Sullivan Show, and I was kind of a contrarian back then. I decided I didn't like them, and so it was just too much screaming. I walked away from the TV and found something else to do. But later on, when Rubber Soul showed up in our house, I realized they were pretty good after all, and I've liked them ever since. So
you came around eventually, but it was too much in the beginning for you. And let's talk about that a little bit, John. The screaming at these concerts, was that normal? Did it stay that way the whole time?
Well, I mean, they stopped touring in the summer of 66 because it just got too crazy and they were tired of it and all that. But, you know, the screaming goes back. I mean, we can talk about Frank Sinatra and the Bobby Soxers back in the 40s or the screaming over Elvis in the 50s. With the Beatles, it was more intense, and the music business was built up to exploit it more by the 1960s. But, by the time they stopped touring and started to become a recording band, they really became a different kind of group. They were no longer pop idols, but now more like rock artists.
Well, it was interesting. Our caller, and I'm sorry, I forget its name, but he mentioned how he was kind of a contrarian. Did the Beatles change their musical style because they were kind of bored with it too?
Yeah, the story I usually tell is that, you know, between A Hard Day's Night, which is the epitome of their pop song craftsmanship, and Sgt. Pepper, which is kind of the epitome of their artistic, exploratory, experimental kind of phase. There's only 3 years difference, the summer of 64 to the summer of 67. Boy, that's a very fast stylistic change curve. You know, you can look at Rubber Soul and Revolver and see it happening, but boy, that's an awful lot of change.
Okay, let's go back to the phones, and we have Don joining us in Ontario, Wisconsin. Hi, Don.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I just wanted to say, for me at least, I think one of the attractions of the Beatles was they weren't this sort of little narrow romantic formula like the American pop songs that came immediately before them. They were talking about, you know, they put it in humorous terms, but, you know, real people, real, like, neighborhood and domestic situations, you know, somebody running away from home and a meter maid and, you know, uncles, and just, it was almost like a community, you know, the characters in their songs. It's almost like a little mini Shakespeare or something. You had
right,
such a range of personalities.
Thanks a lot, Don. So Don's getting it, sort of the slice of life quality that a lot
right.
of the Beatles songs had, instead of sort of a generic She Loves You, Shooby-Doo, like the 50s
right.
stuff.
Very much under the influence of Dylan. He's the one who really prompted John and Paul to get away from the teen love lyrics into something a little bit more sort of serious and what we would call sort of authentic these days.
And speaking of Dylan, Peter from Appleton, you want to weigh in a little bit? I think you have a story about Bob Dylan.
Sure. Well, I think you may have just answered the question. I had heard that when Dylan met the Beatles, that Dylan told them that they really had nothing to say, and this really shook John up, and I wondered if that was true, that he changed his music after talking with him.
Well, they were already big fans of Dylan, and I think it's good to remember that Dylan didn't become really a high-profile solo performer until the summer of 1965. So when the Beatles met Dylan in New York in fall of 1964, probably August of 64 is the meeting you mean, you know, you pretty much had to be a folk aficionado to have Dylan records. And they did. They had them and they admired them. So when they met Bob, you know, they were bigger stars than he was, but they very much admired him. And so what he said made a difference.
So they were kind of like hipsters then.
They wanted to be songwriters, and Bob is a fantastic songwriter, and so they admired the craft in his lyrics.
Were they ever rivals, like, say, Simon and Garfunkel and Dylan seemed to have been, or did they get along, Dylan and the Beatles?
Yeah, I think they did get along. I mean, of course, Pete Seeger would have accused Dylan of being too influenced by the Beatles by taking up an electric guitar at the Newport Folk Festival in the summer of 65.
Mm-hmm.
And clearly, you know, both John and Paul were very influenced by Dylan. I mean, right after the meeting with that, all of a sudden the big acoustic guitars start to come out, and we've got, you know, Hey, You've Got to Hide Your Love Away, which if that isn't John Lennon doing Bob Dylan, I don't know what is.
And Bob Dylan was in a band with George Harrison later in life, too.
The Traveling Wilburys, right, with Roy Orbison and Jeff Lynne and Tom Petty.
All right. We're talking about the Beatles today on Central Time, and you're welcome to join the conversation. The number again is 1-800-642-1234. Let's go to Randy from Middleton. Randy, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, good afternoon. I have to take sort of general exception with Professor because I always thought the big break in the songwriting was between the invasion, you know, in January, the time, and the soundtrack to Hard Day's Night, mm-hmm. which I found to be actually pretty darn sophisticated. And sure, it's pop, but I think that's when I started thinking about these guys as very, really serious songwriters. And,
okay. Thanks, Randy. What about that? Did the evolution really speed up when we got to Hard Day's Night?
Well, I think that A Hard Day's Night is in many ways the epitome of their pop song craftsmanship, but also has many of the ingredients in embryo form that are going to turn into the more artistic approach. And if I had the guitar and we had more time, I could dig into If I Fell and A Hard Day's Night and show you how there are all kinds of little musical details in there that get worked out in ways that are more sophisticated than you would find in your average pop tune.
John, do you think we'll ever see another band that hits it this big, that people are this crazy for, that kind of mania for a rock band? Is it possible today?
Gosh, I don't know. Part of that had to do with how focused the entertainment business was back in those days. I mean, the night that Ed Sullivan played, there were only two other channels you could be watching TV, you know. And now everything, because of the Internet, what's great is that anybody can release a CD and get it out there on the Internet. But the problem is everybody is releasing a CD, and the audience is so fragmented. How do you get them all together? I mean, Bruno Mars had a pretty big audience, maybe the biggest in television history at the Super Bowl. But I don't think that was the Ed Sullivan show for him.
John, I want to thank you so much for joining us and revisiting this time in history.
My pleasure.
We've been talking to John Kovach, a rock historian, professor at the University of Rochester.
Coming up next, we'll find out what a weaker-than-expected jobs report means for the economy and for your money on the stock market. I'm Mike Arnold, filling in for Rob Ferret.
I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Say that's on the, I wanna